Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome, everyone, to our podcast series, Hidden Growth Champions. In our virtual studio today, we have Amit Attari. Amit is a seasoned executive who spent many years in the energy sector and has got a fascinating story to share with us. He's also a growing entrepreneur and has been doing some very interesting work in the clean energy space. So we'd love to hear of your latest adventures, Amit, and how things have unfolded in the wake of the crisis. Welcome to our studio. Perhaps tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Sar. It's a pleasure. And that was a very generous introduction from your side. You've already said what was what I would consider the main points of my career. I would just like to add a few more things, mainly on the personal side. So I guess the one thing that's unique about me is it's a very international background. I was born in the UK, grew up in India, and have been working across Europe, North America, Asia, and the Middle East over the last 20, 25 years of my career. I'm an engineer by background, so I have a master's in chemical engineering and a master's in public policy, focused on the energy sector. I've just found this entrepreneurial journey quite surprising, in fact, in my career, because I never started out thinking in that way. And I guess it's just evolved in that sense. So at the moment, I find myself in Singapore, leading firms that are engaged pretty much in the energy transition, but also looking to develop and commercialize certain technologies, build new business concepts, and create lots of partnerships. And that's how we found each other, Sar. So let me just leave it at that. And I hope I answered the question.
Excellent. I think it really gives a bit of flavor to our audiences. I'm gonna touch first, Amit, if you wouldn't mind, on that entrepreneurial journey. As we come across, work with, and partner with entrepreneurs, we often find that theme of we've stumbled across. It was a surprise to us. we've grown into becoming becoming an entrepreneur, whether within organizations, an entrepreneur, or whether leading a business. I guess your entrepreneurial journey started very much within a larger organization. So perhaps if I had to take you a little bit back into where it started, what role did you play at that time, and how did you start that journey into revitalizing, renewing, creating something new within a big business?
Yes, indeed. I think that's a very, very good observation on your part. You're right. I didn't come with the entrepreneurial gene. And if I look at my career, I started it in management consulting and eventually graduated towards the energy sector. So as I was growing in energy, I worked across the UK and the US, and I was then recruited into a company that was formerly called as GDF Suez. That's Gaz de France Suez. It's a French company headquartered out of Paris. Yet the energy or the electricity part of the company grew out of its holdings in Belgium. So I started my career in GDF Suez, or actually at the time when I joined it, it was called just Suez because the merger with GDF had not yet happened. So I started my career over there in Brussels in a division called Electrabel, which was part of the Suez group. And Electrabel had sizable holdings in Europe, but also across several countries in North and South America, in the Middle East, and in Asia. I started in the strategy arm of Electrabel, and I was involved a lot in market analysis, in investment valuations, in various aspects of portfolio management. And this went on, so this business as usual went on for about 3 years, where the bulk of our activities were in the large centralized power generation space. It was rather a staid old space where you build power plants for 30, 40, even 60 years. And you had contracts with these power plants, and that's it. It was a very staid business, which hadn't really changed for many, many years. About 2 or 3 years into my stint there, and now we're talking about the 2010-2011 timeframe, we started looking at a problem of lots of Chinese manufacturers entering Europe with much cheaper coal and gas plants. And we thought that that could massively influence the power prices, and which could put a lot of financial pressure on the assets that had already been invested in and which were already operating. So we started looking at this this problem of the costs of different power plants. And on a whim, I just extended this analysis, not just to coal and gas, but also to other new technologies, new solar technologies, wind, and so on. And pretty soon I realized that I was missing the real story. The real story wasn't cheaper coal and cheaper gas plants. The real story was that the expected costs of renewables were actually seeing a massive drop over time. So there seemed to be lots of technological developments happening. And as a result, there was an estimate that the costs of solar and wind would drop by 50% or even more. And that was quite stunning to see. So I got an intern to work for me and to just do a research, do market research of this analysis. And we then presented it to our management, and the management had a nice hearty laugh about it. And they said, well, you know, it's these greens who are going out and spreading these rumors, but let's get our internal experts to look at it. So then we got the internal experts to look at it over the next year. I assembled a team of technical experts, of financial experts, of strategic experts, and we looked at it. And actually, their view was even more aggressive than the view that we found in the market. But once again, our management was skeptical. So it took one more year to redo the analysis. And every year that we did the analysis, it was found that our estimates became more and more aggressive. We just found that actually it's not a one-off. These costs are falling for these new technologies, and they are falling faster than expected, with the consequence that solar and wind could become very competitive in the short term. And finally, after about 2 years of hitting the management, they actually stood up and said, well, we've got to do something about this. So that set me off on the whole trajectory of looking at renewables and of also adapting my career to look at renewables. So that started NG off on that journey. And this was only the opening salvo, as it turned out, because we then found out that along with renewables, you had other items as well whose costs were falling. The cost of lithium ion batteries, the whole business case for electric mobility, the case for smart lighting solutions, and so on. And then eventually, we realized that we shouldn't be looking at it in the form of verticals. We should actually be looking at the whole, all of these realms in an integrated fashion and looking at new commercial models to deploy them. And in a nutshell, that's how my career in NG progressed. I'm sure we can get into more detail as we go along. But that was essentially the start of my entrepreneurial journey, about looking at these new business ideas and then actually starting new businesses with them. The first business that I started was a services business in the Middle East. And then after that, I was then elevated to the top management in GDF Suez, or as it came to be known as ENGIE, back at headquarters in Paris, to create new integrated energy solutions businesses. And that kept me busy basically in the 2015 or in the 2013 to 2018 timeframe, before I became an entrepreneur. You want to stop me there?
Yeah, just before we go there, I mean, this is a really fascinating story, because I'm hearing that as you kind of, even at the beginning and as you grew up the ranks, you've used data, you've come across information that in a certain context started to paint a picture that was bigger than what the data was, okay? Mm-hmm. And the more you did it, the more the signals became strengthened, the more they got amplified, the more yes. The story became real, it became deeper than just a single data point. Just before we move on to the type of businesses that you've helped create within the NG group, help me to understand the leadership responds to it. And when we speak about leadership, we often forget these are human beings, same as us. They have their own internal conflicts, that they have a certain mindset that they're trying to practice that may have made them very successful. Mm-hmm. How did you see the leadership thinking shift during that time as more information became available, as the signal strengthened and became more consistent and the story became bigger? What happened within the leadership team that ultimately resulted in having the permission to go and build new businesses, more capital being deployed there, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, you're absolutely right that these are ultimately human beings. Your argument is also validated by the fact that I've seen this kind of response, not just in NG, but in other organizations as well, especially after having left NG. So the comment I'll make is, let me just make it more generally, that normally when you start presenting something to management, I guess they are where they are because of their experience and because of their expertise in a particular line of business. And therefore, when you start presenting something new to them, first and foremost, their attention is mainly diverted to firefighting in different parts of the business, to responding to the current situation, to managing their stakeholder relationships, to managing the internal politics within large organizations. So there's all of these mechanisms that are going on, and you somehow need to make a very strong statement in order to hold their attention. So I think at the outset, if you want to gauge people's response and if you want to actually get their attention, you need to make you really need to go out on a limb and make a very strong statement. And in this case, I was really fortunate that the data backed me up. So therefore, within the limitations of that data, I could make a very strong statement to people. And I guess it's quite difficult to get everyone to agree with you and to get everyone to give you attention. Therefore, it's really important to find an internal champion first. To find an internal champion to get someone to be your advocate at that level of top management. And then you also need to find the right levels of support across different functional disciplines. So even if you take it upon yourself to relay the message, you obviously have to be the fall guy if the message isn't validated. But at the same time, for it to succeed, you have to make sure that you have a champion at the top level, and B, you've got equal supporters who come in from different functions. You need people on the technical side. You need people who are the financial valuation experts. You need people who are economics experts. You need people who are strategy experts. And you need all of them to come together and deliver a cohesive message to back you up when you go to your top management. And for that, you frankly have to invest a lot of your own political capital to get people to do that. The nice thing about it is, once people are convinced and once people are willing to put their own political capital on the line, that is already a nice win for you. It just means that the people will then pick it up and begin running. And you have to be at least secure in yourself that this may unfold in ways that you don't expect. So others may take on more of a leadership mantle, and that should be fine for you as long as the message remains in focus. So here in this case, I was quite fortunate to have a wonderful set of colleagues who came together, and we delivered these consistent messages over and over for about 3 years to the management before we started the import of those messages progressively hit the management. Now, to be fair, on their part, you don't get a large company to suddenly switch direction so quickly. They have to keep the business stable. They have to keep the messaging to the shareholders, the messaging to the analysts also quite stable. You can't just have an about turn very quickly. And therefore, you have to progressively engage all of the stakeholders internally as well as externally to start getting that ship to slowly change direction. And that process, with all positive intent, will take time. So one of the lessons for me was a lesson in patience. and lessons in keeping the faith and making sure that and being convinced rather that that good argument would find its way through and that good people would find a way to come together and jointly lead this whole initiative. So that was a very nice experience. It kind of builds character as well.
Amit, I mean, as you were speaking, it kind of reminded me, one of the executives in the energy sector I was speaking to recently, he was describing a very similar process. And he kind of, in one of our discussions, he kind of almost cut it off abruptly and said, you know, 50% of my time I spend managing upwards. Yeah. That was a very kind of a real way of describing the art of enlisting others in the story that yes. you've come across, the story that you're building. You don't have all the facts yet. You don't have all the figures. Yeah. You have to use some imagination in this process as well. But as you increasingly do so, other people start to see themselves in the story. They start to see how this becomes an NG story rather than an Amit story. And that's very gratifying when that happens, right?
No, indeed, that's absolutely right. In fact, a lot of time is just spent in speaking with people. And it's also fair to say that at the start of the process, you have several skeptics because they haven't yet been able to sniff the wind. And so they just keep on being devil's advocates and challenging you. And you have to spend a lot of time in making logical arguments, but also in making different other kinds of arguments as well. Arguments about opportunities it can create in people's careers, arguments about the risks to teams. For instance, a lot of my time was spent in just demonstrating to people the risk of asset valuation impairments in our existing portfolio. And why, if we don't move, we will suddenly be faced with a portfolio that is a fraction of the value it was a few years back and with nothing new to move into. So it's a bit of a carrot and stick argument as well. On the other hand, I speak about the carrots. We're saying that, hey, if we get into new technologies and into new business models at an earlier stage, we stand to reap a lot of the benefits of project valuations before the whole business becomes commoditized. Like if you look at the solar business now, it's pretty much a commoditized business with very limited returns just because it's a much bigger industry now. Whereas for the early movers on the first few projects, you could get a lot, you could get access to government regulated revenues as well. You could negotiate much better transactions with the OEMs for different kinds of equipment because they were keen to get markets. So your bargaining power as a deployer of solutions was much better than it would be today. And that's the story of every new business, that if you get early enough, you not only get better returns, but you're also seen as one of the pioneers of the sector. And you have a much bigger mind space in the sector. You get a much stronger brand. The later you come, you're also seen as as one of the Me Toos, and you come into a sector where the die has already been cast, the economics is already stabilized, and especially if you're in a commoditized business, the margins are already lower. So you come in more as a defensive strategy, and these are the kinds of arguments that you had to play over and over. The satisfying thing was you gradually start seeing mentality shift, mindsets move. And I guess at a moment where people start thinking that the risk of not acting is much, much higher than the risk from acting, then that's when people move. And then they start seeing the advantage to their careers as a consequence of moving into these new technologies, these new businesses. And that's when you start seeing the organization as a whole shift.
You know, I mean, this is really interesting. You know, in research that we regularly do and looking particularly at companies that have made successful transitions, such as the one you're describing, one of the themes that keeps on recurring is the organizational transformation, that this is not just about an opportunity out there that we need to respond to. It's actually an opportunity to change us, to change the business. And leaders with time also see it as an opportunity to change themselves, the way they lead, the way they set up businesses, the way they add value and contribute to the success and the sustainability of the business. So with that in mind, I mean, you've played a very interesting role as an entrepreneur and as a catalyst for NG to build and to transform its business, but not just into clean energy per se, but also very much into a customer-centric space. So tell us a little bit more about where did the customer feature in this early move into the space, and how did customer first thinking influence some of the decisions that you and your colleagues made?
Yes, that's a very pertinent observation. And in fact, it lies at the crux of NG's transformation, but also at the crux of the sector's transformation. If you look at the power sector as a whole, then you have these large centralized power plants, and then the output of this is electricity, and the electricity goes into the grid. So either you have maybe a contract with an industrial customer, or for the most part, you have got these merchant assets which just sell into the power markets. So even if you have an industrial customer, there's no real sense of customer management in the DNA of a legacy power company, because the commodity that you are creating, that's electricity, is essentially a commodity. There's no differentiation there. There's no brand differentiation as well, apart from product differentiation. And you are selling into this nebulous entity called the power markets. And therefore, people are not trained to think about a customer. Now, as a result of the shifts in the sector, what we were discussing earlier, we started seeing things in a very different way. Firstly, we started seeing that silos would not work. So earlier, the company had an electricity business, it had a gas vertical, it had a services business, it had an infrastructure business, and it had a water and waste management business and so on. So now we actually realize that the customers, if you want to make your business customer-centric, you have to start with the problem statement of customer. So what does a customer want? A customer doesn't just want electricity or gas or services or anything. The customer wants an overall proposition. What the customer wants is all of the above, or maybe some of the above in a different mix. What the customer wants is electricity, but electricity supplied at a certain level of reliability so that they don't have to worry about the lights going off. They need certain value-added services for when to use which appliances so that their costs of electricity can be minimized. They need other things as well. There are other sectors that are gradually becoming more and more electrified, like mobility, for instance. So if you look at where the automotive sector is going, it is also becoming more and more electrified. And therefore, when a customer thinks of electricity, the customer thinks not just of electricity used for appliances and in the home, but also electricity used for transport. So now, if you start thinking yourself, if you start putting yourself in the customer's shoes, you need to start supplying a lot of different solutions in an integrated fashion. If you think of, let's say, a large industrial customer or even let's say, a large client like an airport or a port or a university campus, these are complex ecosystems, and they need all of these solutions supplied with the costs being managed. And increasingly, customers are also more cognizant of the aspect of sustainability. So how green are your solutions? How can I manage not just my costs, but also my carbon targets? How can I manage my water and waste recycling, and so on? So if you think from these customers' perspectives, now if NG were to have a business siloed in verticals, we would no longer be able to put the coherent value proposition to our customers. So this led NG, amongst other things, to start completely overhauling the structure of the group. So NG got refocused from industry verticals into geographical arms. So we created NG North America, NG South America, Latin America. There were, of course, the European businesses. And there was Africa, Middle East, Asia Pacific, and so on. And each of these businesses had one single P&L, which housed all of the different solutions that NG contributed. So the client started seeing NG as one cohesive entity. And we then started aggregating all of these services and solutions within the business. Now, as you rightly pointed out, there's two sides to it. One side is the customer-facing one, but the second side is how do you need to transform the organization itself in order to deliver these kinds of integrated solutions? And that's also where we had a huge, huge shift in the way the organization was structured. And in fact, that was one of my principal roles for the last 3 years of my stay with NG, because we were creating these new integrated solutions in the group. I was brought back to headquarters to head these new solutions. And now I was faced with this quandary that that people in the regions understood the strategy, but they did not know, they didn't really have the know-how for how to move forward and how to structure these kinds of deals, how to engage the customers, how to conduct business development, and how to manage the portfolio once these business deals were won. So we created teams from Paris, which would go on the ground in different parts of the group and conduct a lot of training, a lot of business development support. Often we would even go on the ground and actually lead some business development efforts for a brief period of time before handing over to our regional colleagues. So therefore, the mandate that we had was that even if we go and lead business development, it would at best be as trustees of our regional businesses. And our objective there was to make our team at central headquarters as quickly redundant as possible, simply by transferring the knowledge, the know-how, and the customer engagement to our regional businesses. So that was the focus of the organizational transformation. It was firstly to set the strategy, secondly to support the business development efforts, thirdly to have the right amount of training of the regional employees, and fourthly, it was also about knowledge management. So if you have one expert in a particular area sitting somewhere in France or in the Netherlands, and if that person was needed in the Asia Pacific, there would often be a lot of resistance from that person's management to let that person go and be in a different region. So we had to create the kind of incentive region to allow the right people to make their way to the projects all over the world as per the need of these projects. And this collectively led to this transformation happening. Plus, increasingly, we also had progressively escalated targets for moving to these new business streams. So as a percentage of the overall business, how much was coming from the new business areas? And that number would be escalating over time. So that's in a nutshell the kind of transformation that we went through. I'm sure I have missed out several parts of the whole equation, but this just gives you an example of the kind of effort that was needed and the kind of collaboration that was needed in the entire organization.
Now this is really valuable, Amit, and thank you for sharing that. Very often we see this tension that exists between head office and operations, between people in the field and people in the center. You know, that awful saying is, you know, we hear from head office and we're here to help bring in the organization. And you're describing a different approach to it, an approach that both made head office teams empowered, more valuable, being able to really truly contribute not just to the upfront analysis but to the actual building of the business, but at the same time very quickly transitioning the skills, the knowledge, and therefore the decision making and the real empowerment that then resulted in the actual operations and actual businesses. So both parts of the organization saw themselves as valuable, both saw themselves as contributing. There was just one area that I just wanted to just check with you quickly, is the transition around objectives. You mentioned something that very often escapes management teams when they go through a transformation such as this. There's often that indecision or hesitation that comes in of when do we make the accountability for results real? When do we turn from just having an intent or a strategic direction that people could aspire to start to focus on to real targets, progressively increasing, etc., etc.? How did that transition take place? How did we get from we think we should be playing in the clean energy space because these signals tell us that there's some opportunity there, and Amit keeps on, and his team keeps on harassing us and telling us again and again that we should be looking at this and not ignoring it at our peril, to have an integrated set of businesses that are customer focused with real and increasing targets year by year? That is quite a shift. How did that happen? How did the objective setting process feature in this?
I'll be happy to answer this. Let me just first answer one element of what you mentioned earlier, that the level of skepticism that you face when you see someone from headquarters. And you're right, we did face that skepticism as well. But I think the only thing that can work to dispel that skepticism is just the amount of trust that you create. And it's just something that happens over time. So that's why we made sure that we had profiles of people who were not just people whose careers were built at headquarters. We brought in people from different parts of the organization, from different geographies, people who had been on the front line and who could put themselves in the in our regional colleagues' shoes very easily. So all of that helped to create a certain level of trust, a certain level of credibility, so that we weren't just seen as someone sitting in headquarters in the Ivory Towers, but actually creating these new businesses. And eventually, of course, the proof of the pudding comes from the eating, from the wins that we create. So once the wins were created, then all kinds of questions stopped. So coming to the point coming to your question of how we change the targets, I mean, this is also quite interesting. And of course, the answer would be different in different firms with different cultures. So for instance, NG being a French firm has a relatively hierarchical structure. Whereas if you go to a Dutch firm, for instance, or an American firm, the sense of hierarchy will not be as well established. So you would have different models for different companies. In NG, for instance, we ourselves at our level of top management had a certain mandate, but at the same time, we also relied a lot on directives from the CEO level as well, saying, okay, right, here's the law that as a company, we have to shift. There's no choice over here, and you will all be judged on how you make it happen. So the answer for how to make it happen may vary with different geographies. It may vary with the kinds of business portfolios you're dealing with. It may vary with the political forces in play in the country of your operation. But overall, this is the kind of direction that you need to go in. And what headquarters needs to see is evidence of commitment to going in that direction. So when it came to setting the targets, the targets were also set progressively, or they evolved progressively over time, over the first year, the second year, the third year of the transition. In the first year, of course, we just needed to mobilize the message and start seeing the strategy from different parts of the organization. And we needed to see that everyone had a strategy for what they were going to transition with. In the second year, the strategy should obviously morph into real business development targets and into business development efforts on the ground. So you should start seeing the wins. So here the key metric, apart from the deployment of the strategy, was also the top line wins. So how big were the deals won, the revenue stream, and so on. And then, of course, over time, in the third year and beyond, the focus would go from the top line gradually towards the bottom line. Because for the markets, the message isn't just that the organization is moving. The message is that we are moving to new business models that are also commercially viable and scalable. So the crux of the effort was in commercial viability and scalability of the models. And of course, apart from the pure financial numbers, there would also be other various other metrics and various other KPIs in the game as well. For instance, how would NG as a whole manage its clean energy consumption? So what would be the ratio of green in the overall portfolio? Are we creating that change within our internal organization as well? What does NG do by itself? And what does NG rely on its external JVs or partnerships to do? So it's also about creating that level of partnership, both with large companies and small, all over the world. It would also be a big part of this was also the level of innovation. Innovation at the technological level, innovation at the business model level, and innovation at the regulatory level as well, where NG would be in a position to make certain arguments in different countries about how governments themselves could facilitate the growth of these new businesses. So a lot of innovative thinking went into all of these three realms of innovation as well. And as a result, NG also had to adapt its internal organization to make interesting acquisitions, to grow these acquisitions from technological proofs of concept into commercial proofs of concept, and then to find a way for these new technologies or new businesses to permeate the whole of NG's portfolio in the regions of significance. So this just consumed a lot of time over the first 3 years of the transition, and that's basically how the targets were set. They were set in terms of commercial viability, they were set in terms of partnerships, and they were set in terms of innovation, innovation in NG's business. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, no, very, very much so. And I like the focus that you're giving to the shifts, that setting objective is not a once-off exercise, or there's a firm target to which we all need to arrive at. It's evolving, it's adapting, and that's it's right. Got a different or particular focus that at this point in time or for this year makes the most sense. And also what I'm hearing from you is it allowed a space within which teams and functions could figure out how do they contribute, figure out what are their specific objectives and targets based on where the direction in which the organization wants to evolve and adapt into, which is often a critical success factor we find in organizations trying to transform. If you try to define it too strictly, too soon, you often miss out on the bigger opportunity that you just didn't know was there or sufficiently there. And I guess your earlier comment to the customer role in this transformation really talks to that, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. You just need to be prepared as a team to evolve, to adapt, to recalibrate yourself. And this is true at a business level. This is also true at a personal level. At a personal level, that's the advice that you keep giving our colleagues in different parts of the business. That, guys, this is your moment to start really thinking and taking more risks for your career, because there is going to be a major disruption, and it's your choice as to where you want to be after that disruption. If you were thinking of evolving in a different functional role, if you were thinking of evolving in a different leadership or managerial role, if you were thinking of moving countries and getting a new experience, this is the moment. And I must say, NG was absolutely great from that kind of internal mobility perspective, because you got opportunities to be pretty much all over the world. And you had an opportunity also to move through various business lines. So there would be some obvious business subject matter experts, but there would be enough generalists who could actually take disciplines and replicate them across different business lines. So it was an excellent infusion of different skill sets. And it just made the whole career trajectory very, very satisfying within that environment. Of course, for me, after 10 years in NG, the entrepreneurial bug had kind of bit me, starting with the entrepreneurial bug, and it just seemed a natural consequence of where I wanted to go. But equally, there could be various trajectories within Engie, and that's something that is also really satisfying. So I keep giving this message to my colleagues in different companies as well, or to different people in my client companies, that when the company shifts, please be ready to shift with the company and to take whatever opportunity comes your way. You shouldn't have a preset idea of what your career is looking like, because it's quite likely that it's not going to happen that way at all.
That's fantastic. I can just imagine. Amit, now at this stage of your entrepreneurial journey and seeing where the crisis has what the crisis has made visible to us, what are you up to at the moment, and where do you the green economy or what do you see the green economy becoming growing into in the next couple of years?
Right. It's been a very interesting journey since leaving Engie. So that was in 2018. So it's been more than 2 years now. And I've been in Singapore. But I must say that Singapore is really great when it comes to setting up your company and evolving in an entrepreneurial sense, because they make it really easy. So I must say that I haven't faced any bureaucratic issues about setting up a company at all. In fact, it's to the contrary. I could just get down and dirty with the actual challenges of running a business, of getting clients, of building my value proposition, of actual delivery, and of laying the strategy for the future. So over the last 2 years, I have been working in the same domain as an Engie, which is growing these integrated clean energy propositions. And it's been really interesting. On the one hand, I work with large utilities, large energy companies, and have helped them build this kind of business. I've helped them create alliances, partnerships, even financing with different banks or infrastructure funds, and just created the vision and the execution for these nuclear energy businesses, allowing these large utilities to also effect their own version of the energy transition. Along the way, I also worked with very interesting startups or SMEs. And this has been in the renewable space, where we have been commercializing new technologies for solar. This has been in the energy efficiency space, which is more about using analytics and IoT to help make far more intelligent decisions for energy consumption, and therefore allowing you to reduce your costs, reduce your energy consumption, while, of course, not compromising on the comfort level of buildings. And increasingly, I've also been very active in the field of what we term as Industry 4.0, meaning how do you get to a certain level of maturity of digitalization and automation of your businesses. And therefore, as a consequence, how do you get better integrated in the whole digital economy, both in terms of manufacturing, in terms of operations, and in terms of client engagement? So it's been a really interesting journey for these 2 years. Now, everything started off pretty well, and the first year and a half were absolutely great. And then, of course, COVID hit. COVID has had a big impact, at least in the start. In the start, where you obviously saw the level of business dip, but then that also, I would say, it was kind of a blessing in disguise, because for the first time in years, I just got a chance to catch up on my sleep, and more importantly, I got off the treadmill, and it allowed me to reposition. It allowed me to really focus on the strategy for the future. For getting to the next level of operations, and of course for making my pitches to new clients for the next stage of my business. And happily enough, from Q3 onwards, I really saw the benefit of these efforts. I started a new phase of engagement with multiple new clients, and things seem to be evolving as a business. Now, in terms of the broad consequences, but actually, Sar, was your question from the perspective of my business, or was the question from the perspective of the impact of COVID on the energy sector or the economy as a whole? I just want to check that.
No, I guess both. I see them very much linked. So, New York is what you've seen, both the impact of the crisis, but how, I guess, more interesting for our audience might be, how has that affected you? How has that affected your business and your thinking about what you are building?
Okay, so I'll confine myself to just that part of the influence of COVID, which I think is really pertinent here. For the energy sector, COVID created one big challenge and one big big surprising observation. The challenge was that demand just dropped off a cliff, and the occupancy rates of different kinds of buildings, whether it's hotels or schools or airports or offices, it just fell down to about 15-20% of the usual level of demand. But at the same time, even if occupancy went down, the energy bills themselves did not come down to the same level. The energy bills have come down to barely 80-85% of the usual levels. And that shows how much inefficiency exists in the way we have designed our buildings, in the way we operate our buildings. There are some legitimate reasons for why buildings' air conditioning should be at the same level. If you are an airport or if you are a big hotel, you just having fewer guests doesn't mean that you make it uncomfortable for the guests who remain. So obviously, there are some mitigating factors there. But for the most part, you find that energy demand does not modulate as well, simply because of the way, simply because of the inefficiency of design and the inefficiency of user response. And that presents a huge opportunity to me and to some of my partners in the energy efficiency space. So that has really gotten us to make these kinds of tailored arguments. And these arguments are resonating with a lot of our customers, who obviously do ask themselves the questions that, hang on, if I am to stay viable as a business, if I am, let's say, a hotel arm with, let's say, 50 different hotels spread all over the world, if I want to stay competitive with other peers in my industry, then I need to be able to control my costs a lot more intelligently. The extent to which I can control my costs better will make me, will improve my viability as a business. And therefore, I need to look at all opportunities to squeeze my costs, but without compromising on the customer proposition. So if I as a business can go to them saying, look, we have these solutions which can be deployed on your site, which require very little or even zero capex, and which can translate into lower costs without any compromise on customer comfort or on occupant comfort, then that would obviously find an audience. And the beauty of these solutions don't even require a physical presence of someone on site. They can all be done remotely. They can all be done with the customer's own electrical engineers who just need to make minimal invasive equipment additions on site, and which can be done relatively painlessly. So that proposition has found an audience, and as a result, we see our business growing quite well in the energy efficiency realm. The other surprising observation that everyone saw was the way the environment responds to the lesser number of people on the streets. We have seen how wildlife or wild animal life reclaims urban spaces. We have seen rivers and streams become a lot cleaner. We have seen skies clear up, like mountains in the distance being visible for the first time since before the Industrial Revolution, skies clearing up. And people like what they see. People like to feel like, yes, I've seen the impact of a much cleaner world on my own psyche, and I don't want to lose this the moment COVID lifts. I would want to keep this going because this is good. This is an aspiration. I know that with industrial activity, we will start, when industrial activity returns, we will lose some of this. But how about trying to imagine a world where we really are able to minimize the effects of pollution on the environment and can actually move towards what we term as a circular economy. So this has also made our position a little simpler, because now we don't need to get people to imagine how things will be once we have succeeded. They've already seen what success looks like, albeit in a really, really difficult world from a medical perspective.
Yeah, no, very, very much so. These are really wise words, Amit, and I think many of our audiences can relate to this and have seen signs of this in their own environment. Amit, we could spend the next hour to keep on talking about this and some of the lessons and the tools and the methods that you have used to catalyze change, to help both your organization transform and the lessons you're using now in your entrepreneurial journey with your own firm. We might want to ask you to come back for another episode to complete the conversation. But for now, I just wanted to say thank you. And very much appreciate all the insights that you've shared with us in this very human story. And for those out there that are grappling with transformation, that are grappling with what our organization should become, and the bigger, the more profound question that we should be solving together with customers, I hope this was useful. So thank you, Amit, and I hope we see you back soon.
Thank you very much, Sar. It's been a real pleasure. And I really hope that our audience finds this useful. I must say, I was rather surprised to see that 1 hour had flown by. But time flies when you're having fun. So thank you once again for this opportunity for me to be here on this podcast with you, and wish everyone a safe passage through these trying times.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.